Exodus chapter 1 review and Exodus 2:1 through 2:10. The second talk in a series on Exodus was presented by David Crabtree on March 31, 1996 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 1996. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
I started last week, and I spent so much time on background that I barely got to chapter 1. So I'm going to review chapter 1. I'm not going to review the background. Exodus is about, it's a story about God making of the Israelites a nation for him. It's something that he had promised to Abraham, and in Exodus we see it actually happening, that God takes this motley bunch of people, just they aren't a nation, they're just people who are related to each other, and he makes them into a nation, not just a nation, but his nation. And so the book is about God revealing himself to this people, and in the process, God helping this people to come to understand who they are. And Exodus is essentially a description of the events that take place in this process, how this process happens, and is presented from God's perspective, which is a unique viewpoint from which to view this process. I think what we're most familiar with is seeing that process through our own eyes, of God taking us and making us familiar with him and making us aware of what kind of people we are. But in Exodus, we have it through God's eyes and not our eyes. The background to Exodus that I told you I wouldn't tell you is that God had picked out Abraham, a man at random in Sumer, and said, "I'm going to bless you." It reminds me of a story, but I won't tell it. I will restrain myself. God just picks this man at random. He says, "I'm going to bless you. I'm going to take you away from here. I'm going to take you to a land that you do not know, away from all of the people that you do know. And I am going to make of your descendants a great nation, a special nation to me. They will be specially blessed. And from the line of Abraham came Isaac and then Jacob. Jacob then, through four wives, had 12 sons. And through God's orchestration, Jacob and his sons ended up in Egypt. And that's, there were 70 people in all that left Palestine and migrated with Jacob and his sons. 70 people in all went into Egypt. Now, Exodus starts about 430 years later. And now, 430 years having passed, the descendants of Abraham are much more numerous. And that constitutes the problem that we see in Exodus chapter 1. And there's a problem that was perceived by the Pharaoh of Egypt. He looks out at his realm. He's looking at the potential dangers to his realm. What kind of threats, what kinds of problems are there here that need to be addressed? And a problem that he identifies is the proliferation of the Hebrews, of these descendants of Jacob. And he foresees this being a major issue. He fears a series of things happening. One is that they will continue to multiply. So there will be lots and lots of them. The second, then, is that these Israelites would side with any enemies of Egypt. And the third is that they would leave the land, that the Israelites would take off, leave Egypt. So Pharaoh decided that measures were necessary. Something had to be done. And he starts out by saying, let us deal wisely. He's thinking about this problem, and he thinks he comes up with a plan. How are we going to deal with the multiplication of these Israelites? And his plan is to enslave them. Apparently his thinking is that if they are made slaves, he can achieve two things. One is to cower them, to make them fearful, and the other is to bring them under greater control. So we can have slave masters to watch over their movements and to make sure that they aren't getting out of hand, that there's nothing subversive taking place. But having done this, what he noticed happening was the Israelites continued to multiply. Apparently he either hadn't foreseen this or he thought that the growth in the numbers would decrease. So his response to that was to increase the severity of the labor, make it more arduous, make life less pleasant. And the result of that was the Israelites were embittered. So now, if there was not a problem before, his actions to solve this problem have made the problem. There's no indication that there was bitterness before. There is indication that there was at this point, after he had tried to solve his problem. So Pharaoh takes another step, and that is to order the midwives, the Hebrew midwives, to euthanize, to kill any baby boys that were born to the Hebrews. Apparently his thinking is, I would like to reduce the number of Hebrews, but I want to do it in a covert manner. I don't want to be too obvious about it. So I will enlist the support of the Hebrew midwives, put pressure on them to deftly put the sons to death. And that will take care of the problem. But the midwives, they were willing to risk the wrath of the Pharaoh, one of the two or three most powerful men in the world at the time. They were willing to risk his wrath because it was wrong. It was against their conscience to put those boys to death. So they refused to do it. It is a little of some interest, I think, and something that we'll need to talk about in the future. But their response when they were called to account for their refusal to obey the Pharaoh, in verse 18, he said to them, "Why have you done this thing and let the boys live?" And their response is, "Because the Hebrew women are not as the Egyptian women, for they are vigorous and they give birth before the midwife can get to them." Not a wholly truthful answer. And yet, they are praised by God. And in 21, and it came about because the midwives feared God that he established households for them. So that's this issue of being fully truthful is something that we're going to come back to, because the same issue comes up several times in Exodus. So Pharaoh's next step in response to that didn't work. His next step is, okay, slave masters, anytime a Hebrew boy is born, throw him in the Nile. We'll take care of it that way. No more messing around. We aren't going to ask the midwives to do anything. We're going to take care of this problem ourselves. Drown the baby boys. Okay, so that's essentially what's happening in chapter 1. And I pointed out there are two observations here that I made from chapter 1, and I'll repeat those briefly. The first is, And this seems to be a theme in the Old Testament in particular, that the wise plans of rebellious man are doomed to backfire. God seems to be determined to make sure, to guarantee, that rebellious man will fail to achieve the purposes that he sets out to accomplish. To fulfill the simple desires of life, the most basic things, he will fail at that. The first time I saw that was in the Tower of Babel. If you don't remember that story, I encourage you to go back and look at it in Genesis chapter 11. But they saw a problem, and the problem was that they would be scattered. They had a good thing going, and they were afraid that they would be scattered. So how are they going to keep themselves together? And their solution, let us deal wisely, their solution was to build this tower, apparently as both a fortress and a kind of source of civic pride. And everything that they wanted to achieve by building that tower, as you go through the account, you can see that every one of those things they failed to accomplish. God made sure that the very things they set out to do by the plan brought to futility. And that seems to be God's strategy, is to say to us as sinners, I am going to guarantee that you will fail to fulfill your most basic desires. The things that you set out to do, I'm going to guarantee you fail. Because without me, I can't allow you to succeed. You weren't made to live as autonomous beings. And God is determined to prove that to us. As a result, sinful man tends to sometimes see problems where they aren't, and sometimes to not see problems where they are. But more commonly, sinful man does perceive problems. But the question is, how can those problems be solved? Why is it that sinful man consistently comes up with the wrong answers to problems? And I was thinking about this. I think the solution is most of our problems, in fact, all of our basic problems in society, in relationships, everywhere, are at heart a moral problem. You can take social problems, take welfare, education, abortion, the growing disparity between the wealthy and the poor in our country. We can go on and on. The problems that all of the presidential candidates are addressing, they are essentially, at heart, they are moral problems. They are problems that stem from our rebelliousness towards God and unwillingness to be faithful to his principles. It makes sense, then, that if that is at the heart of our problems, that a human being who won't acknowledge that will misdiagnose the problems. When they're analyzing what's wrong here at heart and how can it be addressed, they always misunderstand what the problem is in its essence, necessarily. Psalm 111:10 says, wisdom begins with fear of the Lord. And I think what that means is you can't understand the problems that come along in life unless you understand that at the root of all of our problems is a moral issue. In order to come up with answers to our questions, we need humility before God, a recognition that we are creatures and that he is the creator, he is the master, and that there needs to be reconciliation between us and that we need to be obedient to his principles. Okay. The other observation from chapter 1 is that God approves those who act righteously even in the face of the wrath of those in power. That's what he did with the midwives. And their efforts frustrated Pharaoh's efforts, Pharaoh's attempt to do evil. And God praised them for it. Okay, so chapter 1 is just laying some background there and for the rest of the book, which is going to tell about the Israelites leaving Egypt. And it's just setting the stage for this dramatic departure that's yet to take place later on in Exodus. And things have to get worse before they get better. That's one of the striking things about Exodus, is the extent to which God is willing to allow things to get worse and worse and worse before he steps in and acts. Okay, then in chapter 2, we focus in on one individual. At this time, when the Israelites are particularly being oppressed and persecuted by the Egyptians, God is, at the same time, preparing for their deliverance. And he does so by the birth of a man, one man in particular, Moses. Chapter 2, verses 1 and 2. Now a man from the house of Levi went and married a daughter of Levi, and the woman conceived and bore a son. And when she saw that he was beautiful, she hid him for 3 months. If you imagine yourself, parents, your wife's pregnant at this particular time, and you're an Israelite, and you know that all male babies born are going to be put to death, it must have been an agonizing 9 months. And it must have been even worse when the baby's actually born, when the sex is determined and it's seen that it's a boy. What do you do then? I mean, parenthood is a hard process to go through. There's a lot of anguish involved. And yet it's a very rewarding process, no question about it. And any parent, I think, would have to empathize with their situation. The baby is born. It says, and when she saw that he was beautiful, she hid him for 3 months. Or when she saw that he was good would be another way to translate it. In the account, Stephen gives an account, his version of the birth of Moses in chapter 7 of Acts, just before he was stoned. And we'll come back to this account in a few minutes. But when he refers to the birth, he says, she saw that he was beautiful to God. Or the word, the Greek word could also be translated. It's a very flexible word. It could be translated refined or elegant, pretty, witty, clever. Has a wide range of meanings, this particular Greek word. I should point out that the Hebrew word has a wide range of meanings as well. The word is, it can be good, it can be morally good. It also means beautiful. So it's not clear to me exactly what she saw. My suspicion is that she looked at this baby and she saw there was something about the baby that she sensed that this was not an ordinary baby. That there was some sense in which the hand of God was on this boy. But it's not clear exactly what she means there. In any case, she decided she wanted to do whatever she could to save this boy from death. So she hid him for 3 months. Now, it could be that this boy was kind of like a couple of our children that slept for the first few weeks after they were born. And it wouldn't have been hard to keep them in seclusion for those first few weeks. But after that, it becomes more tricky. A lot more crying, a lot more noise. It's not clear to me what Moses' parents' circumstances were, whether they were living with their master in the same dwelling, or were they living in a separate dwelling. That's my suspicion. But in any case, she was able to successfully, apparently, keep his presence unknown to the master, to the Egyptians, for a period of 3 months. But after that, it looked like it was the situation becoming more tenuous. You wouldn't be able to keep him quiet. You wouldn't be able to keep his existence hidden. So she comes up with a strategy. Verse 3. When she could hide him no longer, she got him a wicker basket and covered it over with tar and pitch. Then she put the basket into it and set it among the reeds by the bank of the Nile. And his sister stood at a distance to find out what would happen to him. Now, we have to imagine, what is she thinking here? Why is she using this strategy? The only thing I can think of is she's essentially desperate. What do you do? You want the child to live, but you can't keep him in the house any longer. So what do you do? And her solution seems to be to take this baby and put him in a place where he might be seen. She doesn't put him out in the current. She puts him along the shore in the reeds where it's unlikely he's going to drift away. He's going to stay put. So she's putting him apparently where he might be seen. I think that her scheme is maybe someone will find him and have mercy on him and decide to let him live and bring him up. That's the only rationale that I can come up with for her action. But in any case, it's an act of desperation. There's no guarantee that this is going to work. Someone could come along and see the baby and say, a Hebrew baby, boy, and just turn the basket over. Just dump him in the water. So there's no guarantee that this is going to work. But apparently what she's doing is hoping against hope that someone with a sense of humanity will see this baby and decide to let the baby live. And it could be that she knew likely places to put this basket. A place where someone might come, and in particular the Pharaoh's daughter might come and see the baby. It's not clear whether she knew that much or not. But in any case, she did place the sister, Moses' sister, in a position to be able to watch to see what would happen, to find out what would happen to him. In verse 5, then the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the Nile with her maidens walking alongside the Nile. And she saw the basket among the reeds and sent her maid, and she brought it to her. So someone did see it. It happened to be the daughter of Pharaoh. And she sends her maids to have it brought to her. Verse 6, when she opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the boy was crying. And she had pity on him and said, this is one of the Hebrews' children. And so she opens it up, and she sees this baby Hebrew boy crying, and she does have mercy on it, on the baby. There is humanity there in her. And she responds accordingly. Now, I don't know whether it would have been obvious to everyone just by looking at the baby that this was a Hebrew rather than Egyptian. It's a male. It could very well be that he was circumcised. The Egyptians did not circumcise themselves. So it could be that that was the tip-off. Or it could be that there are other indications. But in any case, she recognizes that it is a Hebrew. She has mercy on him and decides to take him in. Now, the word that's used, Hebrew, is used a number of times in Genesis, in Exodus, and throughout the Pentateuch. And archaeological evidence has uncovered the fact that there was a group, an ethnic group of peoples called the, in most of the literature they're referred to as the Apiru, but that would be the same as the Hebrew. The Apiru were a group of people that came from the area of Palestine. They were not so much ethnically related as they were culturally related. That is, they all had the same kind of lifestyle. They were semi-nomadic. They spoke a Semitic language. And they led their herds back and forth between Palestine and Egypt. Many of them hired on as mercenaries for some of the major armies in the area. And so they were socially defined, not ethnically defined. So they were like the term gypsies, for instance. We use the term gypsy to refer to a lifestyle rather than an ethnic group per se. And my understanding is the Apaches were the same thing in Indian culture. The Apaches were made up of outlaws that were banished from various tribes that came together and formed a new social group, the Apaches. That's similar to the Hebrews. The Hebrews were outcasts from their own societies. They came together as a new social group. And apparently, Abraham and his descendants identified themselves with that particular social group. When they are speaking to foreigners, they refer to themselves as Hebrews. And that's consistently the usage through Genesis and Exodus and the rest of the Pentateuch. So that's the significance of the term Hebrew here. They are people that are not a nation. They are people without a nation to claim. They are outcasts from other nations that have come together as a social group. So, Moses' sister sees the response of Pharaoh's daughter, and she comes running. Verse 7, then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and call a nurse for you from the Hebrew women, that she may nurse the child for you?" And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Go ahead." So the girl went and called the child's mother. Then Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this child away and nurse him for me, and I shall give you your wages." So the woman took the child and nursed him. I think this is a wonderful and very encouraging outcome to this story. Because if you put yourself in the position of Moses' parents, you're looking at your dilemma. This child's going to die. What do I do? And as they look out at their options, all of the options are bad ones. There are no good options. And it seems to me in my life, the difficult issues that I face, it's almost always that situation where there are no good options. I just have to pick the least bad. In that situation, there are no good options. So she picks this ridiculous plan, in a way, this desperate plan of sticking the baby in a basket and putting it in the Nile. But God blesses that choice. The baby is found by Pharaoh's daughter. Pharaoh's daughter agrees to allow the mother to nurse the baby and to raise the baby for a period of time. And it's not clear how long that is, but the ceremony for the weaning of children at the time of Abraham was held at about the age of 13. So apparently that's at a time when the child can now go out and be independent from the mother. It's not clear how long Moses was able to stay with her family, with his family, but it is clear that he knew his brother and his sister. And it is clear that he knew his ethnic origin. He knew he was a Hebrew. He identified with them very strongly. So he was there long enough to pick up quite a bit from his parents. And his mother got paid for it, to boot. That would be great to get paid for raising your own children.
What was in it for the Pharaoh's daughter?
Pardon?
Why did Pharaoh's daughter do that? Just out of compassion?
I assume so. I assume it's just an act of compassion. But it is ironic that at the very time when the Pharaoh is putting the most pressure, being the most oppressive to the Hebrews, to the Israelites, God is at the same time preparing in his own household the means by which the Israelites will be led out of Egypt. Apparently, let me read one more verse. Verse 10, and the child grew, and she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. And she named him Moses and said, because I drew him out of the water. Now, Moses is an Egyptian word, or an Egyptian name. I don't remember what it means. But it sounds like the Hebrew verb to draw out. So apparently that's the significance that was placed on that name. And as it turns out, Moses is the one who draws the Israelites out of Egypt. And that's a very good description of what Moses did do and what God did do with the Israelites. He drew them out. It was not that they went willingly. Now, is it in Acts or is it in... One second, let me find where we are. Acts 7, where Stephen is talking about this incident. He adds some information that we don't have in Exodus. Acts 7:22. And Moses was educated in all the learning of the Egyptians, and he was a man of power in words and deeds. Moses was apparently a beneficiary of the education that would be fitting for a son of the daughter of Pharaoh. And I remember David Roper teaching on Moses, and he pointed out that after the Egyptians kicked the Hyksos out of Egypt, and I talked about the Hyksos last week, and I won't go into it again except to say that they are invaders that came from Palestine and took over Egypt, became the ruling class in Egypt for a period of about 200 or 300 years. Prior to that time, Egypt had been, they've got deserts. Egypt had a desert on its east and a desert on the west, and they had been largely protected from any invasions prior to that time and didn't even think in terms of being invaded and were largely ignorant about the world outside of Egypt. But after the Hyksos came in and invaded and the Egyptians chased them out, from then on, the Egyptians became hypersensitive about all that was going on in the area to the northeast of them, that is, in Palestine, because they knew that any invasion that would seriously threaten them would come from that direction. It's the only place it could come from. So, starting from the time that they kicked the Hyksos out of Egypt, the Egyptians began to change their foreign policy. And one of the things that they did after they pushed the Hyksos out, they went on to conquer most of Palestine, to subdue it and make the princes in the area, the Canaanite princes that were then inhabiting Palestine, make them tributaries to Egypt. And one of the ways that they kept the princes in Palestine honest was to take their sons and, purely for educational purposes, bring them to Egypt. It was kind of a safeguard against any princes in Canaan in Palestine revolting against Egypt. Because if they revolted, they might lose a son. The prince might lose a son. So they would bring these sons to Egypt, and they were educated there. Which means that Egypt became the largest repository of information about the peoples of that area that existed in the world. If you wanted to know about Palestine, the best place to learn about it was Egypt, because they had resources and historical sources from all of those areas, and they watched it very closely. That's interesting because that means Moses grew up, was educated, probably with a great deal of knowledge about Palestine and the Canaanite peoples, and about his own traditions and culture and background, that is, of the Hebrews. I think about that when I was studying Genesis in particular. You say, well, traditionally Moses has been considered the author of the Pentateuch, of the first five books of the Old Testament, so that would include Genesis at last count. And where did he get all of his information? I don't know where he got all of his information, but I do know that he was given the best education possible at the time in Egypt, at a time when Egypt was particularly concerned about knowing the cultures and the peoples of Palestine, the area from which Moses' ancestors came. Okay. I think that I better quit there. I had intended to go much further, but I've decided not to. Questions, comments?
Mm-hmm. Were the Hyksos booted out before Moses was born, you're saying?
That seems to be the best way of putting together the chronology. Now, I think at some point I will devote one time to talking about the problems in the chronology and putting this stuff all together. But it seems like the most reasonable way to put it together is that Joseph came down to Egypt at about the time that the Hyksos took control. So Joseph became the number two man under a Hyksos pharaoh. The Hyksos were then kicked out prior to the time of Moses, and so Moses is being raised by an Egyptian under an Egyptian pharaoh rather than a Hyksos pharaoh. And so that's the significance of when it says a pharaoh who did not know. Now a new king arose over Egypt who did not know Joseph. Other questions?
Mm-hmm. I was wondering if one of the possibilities is that Moses' mother, when she saw him when he was born, that one of the possibilities could be translated, she saw he was beautiful to God, that there was maybe something special that she was able to detect. Mm-hmm. That could it be then placing Moses in the reeds in the Nile, rather than being so much an act of desperation, might have been more an act of trust and whatever God has planned for the special child to be?
Yes. I'm not sure I'd make that a distinction, though, because I think it is true. I think it probably is true that she saw him as being a special child, that there's some sense in which God's hand was upon him. But still, she's faced with the question, what do I do with this? How do I preserve this child? What concrete steps do I take? And as she's looking at the options, there are no good options. This one of putting him in a basket in the river, doesn't occur to me as being a great option. So she's looking at all these bad options and she says, of all the bad ones, this is the least bad. I will proceed with this one. God have mercy on me. God's going to have to pull this one out. All I can do is choose the least worst of all these options and proceed, and God's going to have to come through. I suspect that that's what she's doing. So in a sense, it's an act of desperation. What else do I do? But all she can do is pick the least bad, and then God's got to do it, an act of faith. So I wouldn't see the two as incompatible. There's a sense in which they're both, it's both an act of desperation and an act of faith. Anything else?